Hey, Dan.
Hello.
Hey, Matt. How are you doing?
Doing good. Doing good. How are you?
I'm doing okay, but I have to admit I'm succumbing. This will be the first Blogging Heads where I'm using a handset.
A handset?
As opposed to, like, the earpiece thing where I can, you know, my hands are free.
Oh, I see.
I finally have a technical difficulty that requires me to actually use a handset.
Well, there you have it.
Yes.
Yeah, I'm using my super high-tech iPhone earphones that are also a microphone thing.
Does it make Julianne fries?
No.
That's too bad.
No. And it's back to school for you?
It is back to school, yes. The last month has been quite the experience. So, teaching and making my students read Thucydides again. I'm, you know.
Thucydides, right. But so, we were gonna talk. Oh, no, wait, not first. Sorry. But what were we going to talk about? Time Select.
Yeah, I think we were going to embrace the death of Time Select.
Time Select, yes. It's gone. So, now people can read New York Times op-ed columnists for free again.
Raises a really important question, though. Is this a good thing?
Is it a good thing?
Yes.
Probably.
Okay, go on.
Well, okay, I'll tell you this. I mean, I always felt a lot of, as a blogger, as a professional blogger.
Right, you're a professional
I had a lot of Time Select dissonance because, you know, I got a Time Select account because I figured, you know, it's my responsibility to be informed about these things. So, you know, mm-hmm. I would read Krugman, read Brooks. Those two I felt were sort of the most vital Times columnists, but, you know, some of the other ones as well. And it seemed to me as, you know, someone who comments a lot on the public debate that, you know, I should write things about these columns that they were putting out because they're, you know, important, influential elements of the debate, but then readers would get all kind of pissed off at me for, you know, linking.
How dare you link to paid content?
To paid content, which sort of goes a bit against the whole blogger ethic.
Right.
You know, and I didn't really even know what to do. So now that dissonance, you know, is just kind of gone, and I can, you know, link without fear.
That I understand. No, and there's no question. I mean, you know, the New York Times op-ed page still is, you know, the page that sets sets the conversation. And it's nice that, you know, it can once again be the topic of conversation among bloggers. And it actually struck me as odd, frankly, that it was the op-ed column that the Times pursued the exact inverse of what the Wall Street Journal did.
Sure.
Which is the journal always made the news stuff the stuff that they thought was valuable and required to be paid, whereas the op-ed page, you know, mostly the editorials and op-ed page was for free, whereas the Times, for some reason, seemed to think it was the reverse. I suppose there are two things. The first is whether this, you know, what this augurs for, you know, online newspapers. The second thing is I have to admit that I have a small bit of aggravation about this, because the thing I always liked about being a blogger, and admittedly an amateur blogger, is that if the Times was behind a firewall, mm-hmm. The columnists were behind a firewall, it meant, I didn't have the dissonance you had, which is I decided I just wouldn't link to them, except under extraordinary circumstances.
Right.
Which saved me untold hours of reading this crap.
Uh-huh.
You know, and to be fair, I don't mean to, I should qualify the term of crap, which is, you know, I have this theory of the law of crap, which is 90% of everything is crap, including, you know,
it's pretty bad. I mean, I think, you know, that format, which, you know, I've written for a little bit, and I think you have as well, is really hard to, express anything worth saying in that format. And to do it the way the Times does, where those columnists write twice a week,
right,
at that bizarre length, mm-hmm. I feel like almost guarantees bad results. I mean, I feel like almost everyone feels that all of the columnists at the New York Times did better work before they became New York Times op-ed columnists.
No, I think you're right. I think that's a universal. I think that is a universal assessment. And I have to admit, I have more sympathy for them than I used to. I mean, I started writing a monthly column for a few years for the New Republic Online.
Right.
And even just that, I mean, that's once a month.
Right.
It's not eight to ten times a month.
Right.
But, you know, it still required thinking up a theme. And you know, they gave me at least 1,000 words to play with. These guys have, what, 800, 700 words to play with?
Right. Well, and also less, you know, I mean, when you write a column for online, you know, you always have a little flexibility, right? If there's some compelling reason, it needs to be 1,017 words.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it can be done. Whereas, you know, the strictures of print, especially when you're looking at small lengths like that, get quite severe. You can't bring I mean, there's no room for, like, for Paul Krugman, for example. He can't discuss any economic issue in any meaningful level of detail in that space. And, you know, nor can David Brooks actually explain any sociological points in a way that would convince anyone. Not necessarily through failings of theirs, but, you know, you have only so many words, and then you have to waste maybe a quarter of them on pretty much, you know, coming up with a lead.
Right. On the other hand, you know, it seems like that word count is actually too much for Maureen Dowd.
Yes.
I think if you cut Maureen Dowd in half, she'd actually have better columns.
Possibly.
See, that might be the way to solve the Modo problem.
Right, but she's hugely popular.
That's true. No, she apparently excels at the format because it's, you know, it's fishy. Well, I mean, this was the topic, I think you linked to this. There was a T.A. Frank column in the Washington Monthly.
Right.
On, you know, why is it that, it was about Bob Herbert, and that Bob Herbert, you know, if you're a liberal, you should like Bob Herbert, and yet Bob Herbert seems to not quite provoke the same, you know, reactions that other op-ed columnists do.
Right, yes. He gets no love from anyone. And also no hate, I mean, I guess, was the interesting thing, was that
Right, he doesn't have the Howard Cosell thing going on.
Right, you know, and he doesn't
have... Or Howard Stern, or what have you.
I mean, he doesn't get into the conversation by having conservatives read his column and then denounce him as a fool and a liar, and then liberals say, no, he's right, you know, and that's how...
And the reverse for Brooks, but yeah, you're right.
Right, exactly. So there's no meat there. And to be fair, I couldn't really come up with a compelling analysis of this because I, like most people, don't really read Bob Herbert columns. Except sometimes a specific one will get recommended to me. But you know, it's I don't make a
he's
habit
not on your to read list.
No, he's not. No. He's not. But you know, few of them are. I mean, I guess you started off by saying this, but you know what the. Trying to make people pay for the Times op-ed content, I think mostly just revealed how little value it has. That the main reason I pay attention to the New York Times opinion pages is my belief that other people pay attention to it. Right.
No,
so
it's true. It's a focal point. Yeah.
Right. Well, and just because I worry, you know, I worry that if a columnist says something that's seriously wrong there, that might have a lot of pernicious influence on the world. So I want to know what's happening.
I agree. In fact, that was the point. I had a post up today because you know, I was looking at the op-ed page and Roger Cohen's got a piece.
Mm-hmm.
I think he's filling in for someone. But it was on Nicolas Sarkozy and all the way that the taboos that Nicolas Sarkozy is ostensibly breaking,
right?
You know, as the French president, kind of overlooking the fact that Jacques Chirac said some similar things about, you know, joining NATO or loving America when he first became president in 1995. So you know, it punctures the belief that Cohen has that the Sarkozy is the first in a generation to make all these various points.
Sure, right. No, exactly. And ordinarily, you know, if some random person said something about Nicolas Sarkozy that seemed a little ignorant, you know,
mm-hmm.
who cares? But it's on the New York Times, so you know, it's your duty to as a blogger and scholar to read it and correct them, but when you sort of make it go away, all of a sudden nobody cares.
Right. So I guess the point is, I mean, I agree with you. On the whole, this is probably a good thing, but there are now costs, which is I now actually have to pay attention to what people say on the Times op-ed page.
Sure.
And make the occasional correction.
Roger Cohen's photo, I think, is really annoying. Put that out there.
So just getting that out there. Forget the writing. The man clearly needs some work, is what you're suggesting?
Well, it's just he
or a better photographer, a better lighting.
No, he looks really smug.
Oh, I see.
Smugger than your average New York Times columnist.
That's quite a statement.
I know.
I mean, that's really because this really is the one thing that all of these people have in common. I mean, Krugman, Brooks, Dowd, you know,
sure.
Square. I mean, it's just stunning the amount of, you know, smugness in the...
I'd be smug, too, if they gave me the job.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah.
I don't blame them too much. Speaking of smug... I guess...
All right, speaking of smug...
Going to war with Iran.
Yes,
a smug thing to do.
What?
No, I don't know.
All right, let me ask you a couple things. First of all...
Smug about this?
Am I feeling smug?
Yes.
Well, I'm not sure what I'm supposed to feel smug about. I mean, Let me ask you the following. There was a, I mean, the thing that interests, there are a couple things that interest me about Iran. The first is there was this steady drumbeat, and this goes back to the sort of Netroots thing, you know, that was happening about a month ago, claiming, you know, there's going to be this big rollout on Iran. You know, the neocons are all getting together. They're going to push, you know, you're going to see a replay of what happened during the Iraq War.
Right.
You're going to see the drumbeats beaten on Iran. It's going to start post 9/11. And correct me if I'm wrong, this hadn't really happened.
It seems not to have happened.
Yeah. I mean, it still might happen. You know, I think Steve Clemens, you know, hints in Salon, in his Salon piece that AI, oh no, is going to have some, you know, some conferences on this. But, I mean, I don't think there's going to be a rollout in the same way that there was on Iraq.
Well, the timing now seems wrong. I mean, part of the theory for this was that there would be a, you know, with the end of summer, kind of rollout coming. You know, I mean... Part of the basis of this belief seems to have been a story that this guy, Alex Dabbat, put in the Times of London, who now appears to just make a lot of stuff up.
Is this guy from the Nixon Center?
Yeah.
Oh, okay, do tell. Go on.
So I mean, he was the source for one story that got a lot of this kicking around.
But he wasn't the only one. I mean, Barnett Rubin said something to this effect as well.
Right,
yeah.
Barnett Rubin said something similar, which, you know, it's not clear what that amounts to. The other thing is that there was a period in August when the conservative media appeared to be trying to lay the groundwork for this. National Review had an editorial that said America can never be secure until, you know, the regime has changed in Iran. There was, you know, a lot of talk about us, in effect, already being at war with Iran, that kind of thing. And I think most liberals assume, you know, mostly correctly, that conservative pundits are, you know, in...
Are getting their marching orders from someone?
Well, are in communication with the White House political operation and don't... And probably would stop talking that kind of thing unless, on some level, the administration wanted them to.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
I think the fact that you just said the administration, I think, you know, this speaks a greater sense of coherence now on what the Bush administration wants to do in Iran.
Sure,
actually exists.
Right. I mean, that's true. I mean, it's also divided. The other thing, I mean, of course. Part of what's made Iran, I think, difficult for people like me to think about for years now is that, you know, a responsible approach to Iran necessarily involves having some kind of ambiguity about what America's policy is. But when you have the country led by a group of people who you don't find to be trustworthy, either in terms of the honesty of their statements or in terms of just their ability to execute
their competence
things. Yeah, their competence, their morals to some extent. You know, you really start to wonder, right? I mean, on some level, diplomacy with Iran could be enhanced by the sense that there is a political constituency inside the United States pressing for even sterner measures.
Right.
Right? I mean, it'll be harder to do diplomacy if the Iranians believe that the president is as far out as he can possibly go. Which can provide a perfectly reasonable basis for, you know, Condi Rice not trying to get Bill Kristol on the phone and tell him to shut up. You know, without that necessarily meaning that anybody, you know, actually considers the country to be at war with Iran. On the other hand, you know, once you have one Iraq happen, and the same people, the same president and so forth, still running the country, you know, people worry.
I mean, I'm of two minds on this. I mean, I have to say, I share your concern on this, which is, you know, there might be, if there was a different administration in power, or even a different president in power, I might be more willing to see, you know, a more active policy on with regard to Iran. Not necessarily the use of force, but certainly more belligerent, for lack of a better word. You know, and I don't mean it that, you know what I mean. I mean more aggressive.
Right.
But, you're, you know, I'm with you on this at this point now, which is I can't trust this administration to walk and chew gum at the same time. So how they're going to, you know, somehow finesse Iran out of its nuclear program, it's not clear to me. And so, yeah, my short-term policy preference on Iran is that the status quo persists until January 20th, 2009, at which point, hopefully, a new president with a, you know, new... a new cabinet has a more competent chance of, you know, using all the policy tools at its disposal. So I'm with you on that.
Mm-hmm.
That said, I do think that this is evidence that perhaps, you know, sort of liberal netroots are overestimating. I actually think liberal netroots now are roughly where the sort of conservative movement was 10 years ago, in the sense of still feeling like an aggrieved minority, when in fact they actually have more influence than they realize. I mean, I think the fact that this rollout hasn't happened, and that, you know, if the Clemens piece is correct, you know, although you never know, I mean, most of Steve's piece was basically what he learned in D.C. cocktail parties.
Sure.
But, you know, that said, you know, it sounds like the administration is far from unified on this. The political environment is different because Iraq has happened. And so
right.
I think one of the dangers that people have had is that they've tried to draw general lessons about the way that, you know, the policymaking process works in the United States because of Iraq, without considering the fact that Iraq itself has then shaped the policymaking process.
Right.
So in other words, I do think the instance of never again is actually going to apply in this case.
Right. I mean, the flip side of that, though, is that there was a specific effort during the defense authorization bill, I think it was, for Peter DeFazio and, what's his name, David Ogle.
Mm-hmm.
So it must have been an appropriations bill, maybe.
Yeah.
You know, to put a rider in that would say that the president did not have the authority under either the 9/11 authorization of use of force
or the AUM,
or the Iraq one to
right.
engage in military action against Iran. There was some, you know, interest in the netroots community about this among
right.
Democrats, and then it was pulled by the leadership, seemingly at the behest of AIPAC. You know, in a way that I think made a lot of people less secure about the post-Iraq, post-2006 political environment than they might
mm-hmm.
otherwise be, that, you know, right when it looked like, you know, Bush was sort of getting the political comeuppance for his previous sins, and that there might
yeah.
be some real constraint on his authority, it wound up not happening. You know, and specifically on the Iran issue.
Right, although, I mean, again, one wonders, I'd say this, but I'm not, you know, even the fact is that would be a symbolic measure.
Right.
I understand the political thing, I understand that it's politically symbolic, and therefore, you know, the fact that it was pulled might also mean something. But, you know, again, the point is that, I guess the point is that the same thing, you know, it's not the fall of 2002. And so, while I understand the concerns about, you know, what's going to be done with Iran, and certainly, you know, I'm not saying, you know, don't man a drumbeat on this thing. It's not quite the, you know, it's not quite the same political environment it was back then. And furthermore, you know, and Matt, you've been one of the leading critics of the quote foreign policy community end quote.
Sure.
It's also worth pointing out that the foreign policy community on this issue has actually changed.
By all accounts, there's mm-hmm. extremely little elite level support in any of the relevant dimensions for this.
Yeah.
Right? I mean, there's not among foreign policy analysts,
right.
not among high ranking military officers.
Yeah.
And the fact that the president comes into it as a very unpopular president, as
right.
opposed to coming into it as an incredibly popular one, makes a real difference. You know, people
yeah.
are going to be. When you go back and look at the Iraq debate, you see, like, a lot of people who, like, didn't really say anything, or people were
mm-hmm.
making very ambiguous kind of statements. Whereas, you know, now, anyone who thinks Bush is screwing something up is not going to be shy about saying so.
Exactly, yeah.
I
think we're on the same
we're
on the same ground on this, which is the political conditions in 2002 were very different from now. And so as a result, you know, people are going to be much freer in terms of speaking out now.
Right. Although, it's notable that, you know, constitutionally, there's just very little actual constraint on what the president can do here. Complete with, I saw Barack Obama saying, you know, we need to send the message to Bush about blah, 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 blah. But, you know, I think Democrats, if they think about it for 10 seconds, will remember that when Bill Clinton was president, he was bombing Serbia without congressional authorization. You know, certainly, I think, you know, some liberals did complain about that, others didn't. But certainly, you know, the military followed those orders. There's not some practical question as to whether or not the president can do it, irrespective
right.
of political support.
Well, and part of this is that the Constitution is actually very vague. I mean, in theory, Congress actually has considerable powers on when it comes to declarations of war. But the fact is, in practice, you know, the changing nature of war, in part, and also the sort of modern, you know, the Cold War, foreign policy structure that was set up, basically gives the president a fair amount of leeway. I mean, and I will say, the thing that scares me most is the belief, you know, that you occasionally see in news articles that George W. Bush somehow, feels that he doesn't want to leave Iran to the next president.
Right.
You know, that he wants to deal with his legacy. And, you know, the response I always have to that is, for God's sakes, please let, you know, leave this to the next president.
Sure.
But, I mean, all right, let's add, you know, in terms of Iran, I mean, do you... I'm trying to think if there's anything else that's worth talking about on this. The fact that the problem is we can't talk about what the right policy is right now, because, you know, this relates to a debate that occasionally brews in the blogs, which is, it doesn't matter what the ideal policy is. What matters is what policy can be implemented given the people in charge right now.
Right. Because you could try to outline some nuanced, you know, thing with the 12 steps and stuff, but it wouldn't really mean anything. It never means a huge amount in politics, you know, what some random writer thinks about things.
Right.
But, you know, this is particularly an administration that seems really not interested in, like, being open to outside ideas and, you know, bringing all the voices together and working something out, kind of thing, which has led, I think is where you're going to, like a major trope of progressive bloggers,
right,
has been to try and, like, anathematize wonkery in the sense of, you know, spinning out, you know, somewhat utopian policy ideas instead of, you know, criticizing bad initiatives just mm-hmm. in a full bore way.
Well, I mean, you know, for example, you know, a whole raft of Democratic health care proposals came out this week, right?
Right.
And, you know, you, among others, you, Ezra Klein, you know, Kevin Drum, you know, the sort of usual suspects you would expect to be sort of wonkishly enthusiastic about this, were analyzing all the different plans. And then was it Atrios or Duncan Black that issued something that said, cut this out, or, you know, there's just no point in doing this?
Yeah, I'm not sure it was about the health care plans, but it was about something. He had an old time slogan that wonkery is wankery,
right?
Or something of that nature.
Which I find amusing, given that, you know, his attitude on the foreign policy community is in fact the exact opposite of what he just said, if that's correct.
Right. Well, yes. You know, and I'm not. I'm sort of two minds about what he's saying on that. You know, one thing where I do think it's valid is that I think that over time, some liberals had gotten into a habit of becoming so convinced themselves that conservatives were evil and stupid, mm-hmm. that their only thing they were really interested in doing intellectually was having nitpicking fights with other liberals.
Mm-hmm.
You know, about exactly how these things should go, and that you really saw a lot of this in the sort of between 9/11 and Iraq period,
mm-hmm.
where, you know, people who were to the left of everyone who had political power in the United States were spending a lot of time worrying that people even further to the left of them had not developed, like, pragmatic approaches to the Iraqi weapons of mass destruction program.
Right.
And that this was, like, a counterproductive way for everyone to be spending their time. As a more general proposition, though, about, I don't know what exactly, you know, how politics works or whatever, I mean, I feel like people may as well talk about the details of healthcare plans. I mean, I don't know, try to improve, you know, the interested members of the public's understanding of the issues. Seems mm-hmm. like a good thing to me.
To get this at a deep level, I mean, there's almost an existential question here, which is, do you see yourself as someone who's trying to promote progressive politics, you know, back into power, or do you
Sure.
see yourself as someone who, you know, while certainly having progressive sympathies or liberal sympathies, also wants to be, you know, an honest broker in terms of what you think are good policies and what you think are bad policies? And, you know, the problem with a blogger, of course, is that sometimes you're both. or right. you flip flop on this,
or you feel differently about different subjects.
Yes, that's it. No, that's a fair point as well. Yeah,
I mean, I don't stay awake at night, you know, haunted by the fear that some aspect of product safety regulation, you know, may kind of go awry or whatever. But you know, there are like some issues that there's some issues, I think, to be honest, that you know people care enough about on an emotional level that you know you just really want to see like your side prevail,
and, like a rock.
Right, and not have a some kind of seminar chat about it all the time. But then there are other things that, you know, are more interesting to talk about or, you know, just less sort of emotionally weighted.
This is ironic. I mean, I think this is where we're just on opposite sides of the fence, because I know you like to blog about healthcare a great deal, correct?
Well, I have a little.
A little. I can't stay awake for this stuff.
Sure.
And I don't know why either, because I actually feel guilty about this. It's 1/7 of our economy. It's clearly a big mess. You know, I should be interested in this stuff, and I can't muster the energy.
Right. You know, I mean, I will say, this is why on some level I'm not sure that there's such a deep divide between these different priorities, because, I mean, I think, you know, I think that insofar as one can try to find ways that are interesting to write about substantive issues, that there's like a big problem in the country of people not wanting to read substantive things about the issues because they're boring, and that trying to do a better job of communicating ideas about real things in a way that's compelling to people is actually useful, even in to building political support for good ideas.
I mean, this actually gets to a depressing conclusion I'm drawing quickly, because I think it was the T.A. Frank piece that actually argued that one of the reasons Bob Herbert is so boring is that he actually has anecdotes and then marries them to statistical evidence.
Uh-huh.
And that apparently is a big turnoff for readers.
Right.
That it, you know, cites some evidence. And that there was also a Washington Post story that came out earlier this month about a study that showed, for example, that if the CDC tries to put out a flyer rebutting some myth about disease,
right, then you make it worse.
What? Yeah, that it actually makes it worse. That, I mean, there were experiments shown whereby people were actually given the CDC brochure. They were asked immediately afterwards, so you know, do you think this myth is true? They would say no. But then they were gone. You know, they came back 3 days later, asked them the same thing, and now they thought not only was the myth true, but the CDC said it was true, which. That's really depressing for someone who wants to make an argument, in the policy sphere, because it basically says I can't use statistical evidence and I can't try to rebut my opponent's views. I mean, that actually doesn't leave me with a hell of a lot.
No, I mean that's unfortunate.
In
a lot of ways. I do think one good thing about the internet is that it's kind of. I think it's easier to work some elements of spinach sort of into a blog than into a newspaper column, because, you know, there's not... If you don't face space constraints, you don't need to choose, per se, between, like, trying to make jokes and, you know, link to amusing things and trying to do serious things. And also, you know, you can put graphics up there. Like, anytime I see someone with some long, boring thing that has what seems like a telling, you know, chart in the middle of it, I try to, like, copy the chart and put it on the blog along with a very brief summary of what's happening and a link to, like, the long, more serious discussion of what's happening there. But I do think people, you know, that way at least people can look at it. And you know, the well-made charts are actually very good at presenting certain kinds of information. And you can see in a striking way what's this about. And if it's something you're interested in, then there's links always to more and more detailed things. Whereas in a newspaper, you start going on about statistics, and it's boring in the way that numbers are. But it also doesn't really prove anything. In the way that 750-word columns don't really prove anything.
Yeah.
Which I think it makes the statistics only more boring.
It depends on... I don't think all statistics are created equal. There are some statistics that really, you know, that really grab at you, and then there are others that don't. You know, whenever I talk about... For example, whenever I talk about the differences between North Korea and South Korea, you know, the benefits of relatively free markets versus the North Korean system...
Right.
The statistic I always give is that the average South Korean is now 5 inches taller than the average North Korean.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that's a statistic that actually grabs you and, you know, you know, it makes people wonder, why is that? Well, it's got to be malnutrition. You know, if on the other hand I throw out GDP per capita, that's just going to bore people.
Right, but also, you know, that's a... There's not, like, a large segment of the audience that feels itself emotionally invested in the idea that there's a successful North Korean economic model. you know, and the thing is
that's absolutely correct.
Right, and so, you know, anyone who's sophisticated about these things, you know, recognizes that it's easy to find statistics that appear to support a point of view that's actually wrong. And it means that, you know, in a suitably long format, you can really convince people that your numbers are solid and that you're doing responsible work.
But you can't do it in a newspaper.
Right. I mean, anyone can write an op-ed that has, like, some statistics in it and says almost anything. So that it's, I think, with some justification that people's eyes almost glaze over when they start seeing those kind of statistics. I mean, part of what makes these healthcare arguments boring is that on the one level, you have argument by anecdote. But what seems to progress from there is to sort of argument by random statistical grab bag.
Yeah.
You know, so people will be like, well, look, in France they spend X and they get Y. And it's like, but look at the cancer mortality rates in Portugal. You know, and this is sort of endless duel of, you know, well, can people Google for different statistics? And that doesn't demonstrate anything. And to demonstrate anything meaningful with those statistics, it would have to be long. You would need to have a lot of different statistics and some kind of explanation of why the ones you were using were the correct ones, you know, blah, 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 blah.
So you're basically saying, I mean, I like the way that you're putting this, which is to say, you're actually lifting me from my depression.
Sure.
Which is to say, the statistics can be useful, but the newspaper column is not the proper format. Either you're going to do it in a rigorous paper, you know, or don't do it, basically.
Yeah, or even, I mean, you know... The blog is in some ways almost more honest about what the, like, random statistical dart, you know, amounts to.
Right.
That it can just be like, here's a fact.
Or at least it's interactive. You know, the blog is both interactive and also it mixes statistics presumably with other things that can grab the reader. So.
Right. Or, you know, people can follow to where the data is if they really care and glaze over it. Because, you know, as you say with the North Korea thing, you know, it's possible to find statistics that illustrate points in, I think, very striking and non-dull.
Right. It's just very hard. It's a rare skill than I think we realize.
Sure. Well, and also, I mean, part of this is just, you know, actually convincing people to change their minds about things is incredibly difficult.
Yeah. Yes, and I think it's increasingly true.
I think it's at least, like, one thing you really learn writing a blog.
It's that people's opinions are fixed, and it's not going to happen.
Yeah, and that there are smart people who hold what you think are stupid opinions almost with a remarkable amount of stubbornness, but then they prove themselves to be almost insidiously clever and resourceful at finding new reasons to keep believing the things they do.
You know, that's a book title. You realize smart people and the stupid things they think.
Sure, I guess.
Or stupid people and the smart things. I mean, you could have a whole series of this.
Sure, just back and forth.
All right, I think we've beat that issue into the ground. Should we move on to Greenspan?
Greenspan, yes. Okay, what Greenspan?
Well, I mean, you know, Greenspan's book has come out, and...
Yes.
I mean, what strikes me is there are two things that I think that have made waves. The first was this one line, apparently, in the book about the fact that the war in Iraq was about oil.
Yes.
You know, and which has caused, you know, various people on the left say, aha, I told you so. And then Greenspan walked away from the comment a little bit. And I actually don't know if we really need to talk about this, because I think I agree with, you made a point on your blog, which I tend to agree with, which is, on some structural level, of course this was about oil, because that's the reason we care about the Middle East in the first place.
Right. Well, and it's the reason Saddam Hussein cared about Kuwait.
Right.
I think in some ways more to the point. I mean, I think this being about oil is sometimes in a way that makes the United States out to be unduly insidious here. I mean, nobody would build an army to conquer a worthless patch of desert in the first place. So the question of what measures you do or don't take to stop them from doing that wouldn't arise.
Right, exactly.
Right.
You know, but that said, just because, you know, I mean, I think the problem is that, you know, sometimes if you say the war is about oil, it implies it was about nothing else, which I also don't think was not true. So, you know, it was true. So, on the one hand, this was sort of one of those permissive conditions of the reason we care about the region in general is because oil is there. But that said, there were a lot of other reasons going on.
Yes.
Yeah. But the second thing, which I think is more interesting to me, is the fact that Greenspan felt compelled, you know, in the book to explain why he said what he said about the Bush tax cuts in 2001.
Right.
And for me, I mean, yeah, I had a post up about this. You know, this is part of a common trope now, which is, I think we're going to see a whole bunch of memoirs. I mean, Powell's already, I think Powell wrote his already.
He had like an authorized biography.
Right, yeah, I'm sorry, that's correct. That's a better way of, that's right. Rumsfeld's writing his memoirs. We're going to see more of them in the future. Basically, people who are going to have to explain, this is why I did what I did with the Bush administration.
Right.
And, you know, there are different degrees of you know, association. But the problem is that they all feel like they need to explain away what, you know, is now perceived as mistakes.
Yes.
How well do you think Greenspan does in explaining away his ostensible mistake?
I mean, it was weird because I thought it was always totally clear to me at the time what it was he wanted us to understand him to be doing, but also always totally clear that that wasn't the practical impact of what he was doing. And as he now writes in the book, he was specifically told by people who, you know, Bob Rubin, you know, people who operate in this world and whose views are worth taking seriously, that this is what was going to happen. I find it a little hard to believe that the longtime chairman of the Federal Reserve, who before that, he was some like an official in the Nixon administration.
He was the head of the Council on Economic
Advisors. Right. So, I mean, he's a longtime Washington hand. It's not like he didn't show up yesterday. And how it is that he is supposed to have not understood is something that, you know, I think I was a sophomore in college at the time, and I understood that if Greenspan gave that when Greenspan gave that testimony, that this was going to be written up as Greenspan endorses Bush tax cuts. So,
I mean,
it's just hard for me to say.
I mean, I think I have two thoughts on this. The first is, the first is that I can actually see why Greenspan would have thought that. I mean, in some ways, this is almost a replay of what Paul O'Neill, you know, was doing in the Ron Susskind book, The Price of Loyalty, which is O'Neill seems shocked that Cheney is not the same man that he was in the Ford administration.
Right.
You know, and I mean, I think O'Neill actually talked about getting together with Greenspan at different points when they're talking about the tax cuts. And, you know, crunching the numbers and trying to figure out what's the best way to do this, and maybe we can have, you know, a trigger mechanism whereby the tax cuts stop if the budget deficit gets too large, these sorts of things.
Right.
And so you do have to wonder if part of this is because Greenspan's primary link to the Bush administration was O'Neill, who it turned out was not really speaking for the Bush administration on this point.
Right.
There is a sense in which I'm willing to give Greenspan, you know, a sense of, you know, he thought he was doing the right thing. I mean, in the same way that he treated O'Neill, the same way he treated Bob Rubin, thinking that this was the point man on the, you know, the administration, and turned out he wasn't. You know, second of all, I mean, like you, I agree that, and I disagree with Paul Krugman, I'm not sure what he was thinking here, in that there was going to be a tax cut in 2001. There was no question about that. I mean, even the Democrats were calling for different, for various kinds of tax cuts. The question was going to be how large it was. And you can argue that perhaps Greenspan had an effect that, you know, sort of tipped the balance in favor a little more of the Bush direction.
Right. Although here it is true that in some ways this makes Greenspan's behavior a little bit more puzzling. Because if you know, Greenspan's view was that cutting taxes is a good idea because I'm a small government conservative. I think that if you reduce taxes and reduce spending, that will improve economic growth.
Right.
But he didn't want a tax cut that would just increase the deficit.
Right. I mean, so, that's roughly where I fall.
Right. You know, but given that tax cuts were almost, you know, when Bush took office, the mere fact that he was there sort of made tax cuts inevitable.
Yeah.
Which makes it all the more mysterious that Greenspan's emphasis wasn't on the need to add a deficit trigger to Bush's proposal.
Yeah.
Right? I mean, instead...
Well, to be fair, I think he actually did suggest this. The problem is...
No, he did suggest it. But I mean, this is the point, is that the emphasis of his proposal was on the general desirability of tax reductions, as if the big question was, will taxes go down or not? And the deficit trigger thing was a minor point, when in the real world... there was a debate between Democrats. Some Democrats were proposing small tax cuts. Some Republicans were proposing big tax cuts. And a smallish bipartisan group who was proposing deficit triggers.
Yeah.
And this, I think, was actually the context where Adros most recently said the thing about wonkery and wankery.
Yeah.
The Greenspan sort of went off in the clouds in just his statement in a way that was not sensitive to what the legislative debate was about.
Right. I think that's a fair... It is a fair point. I mean, the other thing to really... That's true. On the other hand, I'm somewhat sympathetic because remember, the concern that Greenspan actually said, if I remember correctly, was that, oh, dear Lord, our national debt might actually be erased if we don't cut taxes.
Right.
And it's remarkably absurd to think now that that's what he was concerned about, but that was actually the mentality he had at this point.
But that's what I'm saying. Like, but that was a particularly absurd thing to think when none of the political actors were proposing that we do that.
Yeah.
You know, so I don't know.
But to be fair, there were CBO and OMB projections saying that this might actually happen.
No, there were, but that's precisely why even Democrats were happy to countenance fairly large tax cuts.
that's
what I keep saying, is that Greenspan's behavior, and even his explanation of his behavior, makes him seem like some somewhat fuddy-duddy macroeconomist who got called in from somewhere and, you know, didn't understand what was happening. When he's a seasoned political operator, surely he was aware that
Al Gore... nothing else is Andrea Mitchell's husband.
Right. I mean, Al Gore had proposed all these tax cuts. The Democratic Alternative Plan involved tax cuts. I mean, there was no practical problem, or whether or not you think it's a problem, there was a realistic possibility of the national debt being paid down. That never happens anyway.
Yeah. No, that's right.
I mean, it is weird for a central banker to have this, like, haunting fear that politicians were going to be hoarding the money and not spending it on anything for any constituents.
I mean, if nothing else, this might be an object lesson in the fact of, you know, Greenspan actually might have been too powerful in 2001. That, you know, because he was seen as, you know, the master of the markets at that point.
Sure.
You know, the fact that he was weighing in on fiscal policy in the first place was probably, you know, it was beyond his bailiwick.
Yeah, I mean, I agree. I mean, the independent Fed concept is a little weird. It seems to work very well in practice.
Yeah.
So I'm all for it, but it's not.
It's anti-democratic.
It's anti-democratic and. I don't think it's a great idea to just try and expand the ambit of that.
We're on the same page there, which is to say, I mean, the Fed's role is setting monetary policy. You don't necessarily want to expend the Fed's credibility on other issues.
It undercuts the purpose of it to turn. Like you see with some of the stuff that's happened with military officers more recently, is that, you know... When you throw these people into political debates, they become political figures, you know.
It gets to a larger issue, which we're not going to be able to resolve in this blogging thing, about the sort of role of experts in a democracy.
Yes.
It's actually telling that one of the few good appointments Bush has made, you can argue, is to, you know, was replacing Greenspan with Ben Bernanke, who's, I would say, has done a pretty decent job, you know, with a much weaker hand than Greenspan had. What's telling is that the appointment was actually important enough so that Bush actually paid attention, you know, or appeared to, you know, appoint someone that even, you know, Paul Krugman approved of.
Sure, yes.
That actually relates to the other question that I think I have about Greenspan, which is what's telling to me is that someone even with Greenspan's reputation still has sort of what's considered a small blight on their record. Because of their association with the Bush administration.
Yes.
And if you take a look at the people who came in with the Bush administration, you know, these people all had pretty damn good reputations prior to Bush 43 taking office.
Yes, there was all this coverage about how awesome his team was.
Right, you know, they were called the Dream Team, you know, it was called the Grown-Ups. Mm-hmm. And the fact that almost all of them, you know, all of their reputations will have taken, you know, from a minor to a really, really major hit. I mean, I think that speaks more of the president than it does of these people. I mean, yeah, obviously these people are culpable, but, it you know, it says something about George W. Bush that that's going to be the one of the legacies of his presidency.
Yes, it does.
And it's just it's a depressing thing, but I thought it was worth saying.
Yes, no, I mean it does. It says a lot. It also, it's in some ways a larger subject, but I think it says something of the dynamics that September 11th set off.
Yeah.
Which created a situation in which people, I think, felt disempowered in terms of what they could do. You know, because one of the reasons such a big deal was made about Bush's team was precisely because from the beginning there were always extremely serious doubts about George W. Bush.
Right, that the team was played up because he was going to rely on them.
Right, and that we were supposed to rely on the fact that he was relying on them.
Yeah, this was persuasive for me at the time.
Right, and give us a lot of confidence. Events conspired to briefly and massively elevate George W. Bush's people's esteem for George W. Bush.
Right, right. It was a rally around the flag effect.
Right, in a way that was nothing of his doing.
Yeah,
And that, you know, sort of threw the whole equilibrium out of balance, and you see him now in what's his name's book where he's. That passage you quoted on your blog. Where
Draper.
He's you know, munching on a sausage sandwich and talking about his grand strategy, and he doesn't seem to know what he's talking about.
It was pretty incoherent.
And you know, the thought that this was someone who was aware of his limits and thought of his skills as being an ability to sort of work with people and bring the best people together and sort of get them in a room and delegate stuff to the right guys, clearly went out the window, you know, for Bush,
yeah.
I think, at some point in time.
Well, it's also, it's related to, I mean, this guy has a very interesting view of what, of how a president is supposed to function. And it's very clear that he thinks, and this was actually something he was somewhat more coherent about in that interview, was he basically made it clear that he thinks that unless he seems absolutely certain about his course of action at all points, and, you know, does not deviate from that course of action, that somehow it's a display of weakness.
Right, yes.
Which is almost the antithesis of how Clinton operated. Clinton's genius, you know, Bill Clinton, when he was president, his genius was to some extent that he could compromise and yet somehow make it seem like the compromise was his idea.
Right. Yes. Yes. I mean, this seems like, I don't want to do too much sort of psychologizing of it, but, yeah. but it seems like the attitude of an insecure person.
I suppose. I mean, basically. I'm reluctant to engage in the psychoanalysis either. It's an interesting. It's an unusual approach to presidential leadership, let's put it that way.
Sure, yes.
And, you know, I think in the end it's probably been proven not to work terribly terribly well.
Right, well, so you see it, right, that these people, I mean, this is where we started, people go into the administration with good reputations, and
right.
They all come out for the worse, and that includes some people, like say, Rumsfeld, who seem to have been personally culpable.
Right.
Significant problems, but it also includes people like Powell and to some extent Rice, mm-hmm. who it's less that they made things a lot worse than simply that they participated in a whole process whose outcomes were terrible.
Right. I mean, I apportion blame slightly differently than you do. So, I think mm-hmm. Powell actually does deserve. Blame for some of the things he did, and most importantly for some of the things he didn't do.
Right. No. I mean, it's not that I think he's blameless, but I mean, it's not that. Say, Colin Powell has been exposed as a lunatic with crazy ideas about the world.
Right. Right. He's been exposed as someone who didn't, you know, who at key moments did something that he probably shouldn't have done, or should have done something that he didn't do.
Right, right. But I mean, it's a pure, it's not guilt by association, but I mean, it all just arises out of having been in the room. If he'd just been an ineffectual ex-general somewhere,
yeah.
who, like, didn't help stop disasters, like, you know, lots of people do that.
Yeah.
Right, but it's like, and it's
Patriots
so...
Patriots wouldn't have liked it, but it wouldn't have mattered.
Sure, right. And it's so universal, though,
yeah.
that it makes it seem like, you know, people can't... The problems are bigger than any one.
Yeah,
one
well, no,
cabinet
I mean, I think,
official.
I think, let me put it this way, it is, in the end, I think, the ultimate indictment of George W. Bush, that precisely you had all these people come in, all of whom, you know, for either for real reasons or for illusory reasons, had, you know, reputations for being, you know, relatively smart, relatively competent people, and yet now, you know, 8 years later, we think of them somewhat, you know, radically, in a radically different way.
Yes.
All right, I think we should get to our last topic, which is how I should get paid.
Oh, how you should get paid. Right, so this was the idea that students should pay bonuses.
Right, I think this had its origins in an Inside Higher Ed piece.
Right.
About that proposes basically that students be given, $1,000 or some sort of, you know...
like a voucher that they can assign when they graduate.
Yeah, it was a James Miller column in Inside Higher Ed on how to promote better teaching. And so that they could distribute every graduating senior gets $1,000 to distribute among their faculty.
Right.
There could be a computer program to allocate the money anonymously,
right.
what have you. And yeah, I posted about this, and I'm less than thrilled with the idea. Although I should point out that I also linked to Adam Smith, who was actually crazy about this idea back in 1776.
Right.
Because in The Wealth of Nations, he writes about the fact that, God forbid, professors draw their salary from universities rather than students directly, those professors won't do anything.
Right. I mean, I guess I think it's a little interesting, just that it seems to me that almost everyone has the view that there should be merit pay for elementary and high school teachers,
uh-huh.
and that the only reason this doesn't happen is the overwhelming political clout of corrupt and reactionary teachers' unions. but then when you take, you know, essentially the same idea into an only very slightly different context...
I got to call you on this one.
Okay.
It's not the same idea. I mean, merit pay for teachers, you know, in high schools and in elementary schools isn't based on what the elementary school kids or the high school kids think of the teacher.
Sure. No. What I meant is that doing something, it seems to be considered so obviously problematic to do mm-hmm. merit pay for college professors that people are driven to these much more esoteric
sorts
of schemes like this.
Yeah.
But that, like, my first response was, well, look, like, if you want to create incentives for college professors to teach undergraduates better, why don't you just make that part of the job description on some level? Which it isn't really. But, like, it does naturally reach the problem of, like, well, like, how are you supposed to know, right? I mean, the president of the university can't, like, be attending everybody's seminars all the time, which is why you get to these voucher things, but then there's all these conflict of interest type problems.
Right.
I think it's genuinely difficult, you know, question of how, in either context, you create the right sort of incentives.
No, that's true. And I think part of the problem here is what is it that professors do and what should, how should they be rewarded? I mean, I should point out that in a fair number of universities, there actually is a merit pay system. But it's a merit pay system usually based on publications.
Right. Well, no, that's what I mean, but not for teaching.
And it's true, not for teaching. Although I'm not entirely sure, I mean, again, the problem is that the university teaching system, it can depend radically on what institution you're at. If you're at, like, a top-tier private institution...
Mm-hmm.
First of all, there's more money around.
Right.
But second of all, what they want professors to do is somewhat different from, let's say, if you're teaching at, you know, a state school where the publication demands are almost minimal, but the teaching demands are much higher.
Sure.
So part of the answer is that this might very well exist in a lot of universities. I'm not sure if it exists. It's certainly not going to exist at the Harvards of the world.
Right.
Or the Tufts of the world, for that matter.
I will say it's very unclear, I think, what good teaching is exactly. Yeah, well, I mean, it's hard to know how to be the best possible teacher, but I mean, they're conflicting priorities since,
yeah,
you know, since the students are adults of sorts, and the material being taught is not, it's not like, well, either the kid is learning to read or else he isn't.
Right, no, that's true.
Kind of thing, and I mean, you know, it seems like there's, you know, a case to be made for letting some children fall behind in the higher education context. If they don't really care. But then there's another case to be made, you know, that there is. But I mean, it seems like reasonable people might just have different priorities.
Yeah, no,
as
no, that,
teachers.
That's a safe statement. I think the other problem with letting, I mean, I have to say, as a professor, the problem with letting students, you know, and I should add, you know, I do get student evaluations, and those actually do play a role in terms of things like promotion.
Right.
The problem with having students, you know, potentially dole out the money is that, I mean, I can tell you from experience, the students that would actually be the biggest problem would not be the students that necessarily do badly. The students that, you know, in my experience when I teach classes, the students that do badly know they're doing badly.
Mm-hmm.
And they're usually not going to put up too much of a fight.
Right.
The absolute pain in the ass students are the B-plus students.
Uh-huh.
It's always the students that are, like, just close to the A. They're not necessarily going to get it. And, you know, it just ticks them off.
Yeah. I don't know. Yes. No. I mean, I think that's true, obviously. Because, you know, you can tell when you're not doing well. And, I mean, oftentimes when people do poorly in college-level courses, it's because they're not particularly invested in doing well.
Well, but I would say it's more than that. I think college is often the first time in a student's life when effort does not necessarily match outcome.
Uh-huh.
You know, it's a situation where most professors, when they're grading papers or they're grading performance, don't care, frankly, how much effort the student put into
mm-hmm.
the paper.
Mm-hmm.
What they care about is the paper good or not?
Right.
Is the math problem set correct or not?
Yes, yes.
And, you know, let's face it, for much of a student, you know, for much of a person's life, the belief is that effort should count for something.
Right.
But you get to a point where, well, not necessarily.
Right.
And that's not, you know, it's not necessarily, and what I've noticed is that often the B-plus students are the ones who actually do put maximum effort, you know, into their schoolwork, and it just doesn't quite yield the same results that it used to.
Sure, right. Well, and a lot of people, I mean, I know this happened to me in a symbolic logic course I took. You know, you struggle with the idea that for the first time you're facing work that you really can't do
right
perfectly, well, even if you try really diligently. That, you know,
yeah.
You know, all throughout high school, I mean, I screwed up tests and quizzes and stuff, but it would always be like because I hadn't studied, rather than, you know, like I tried my best and like it was just too hard.
Yeah, which was certainly when I was in econ grad school, I had that experience.
Right. But I mean, eventually you get to the level in some field where you can't keep up with the other people who are better at it.
Yeah, no, that's actually what I was talking about. No, it's true, and you hit that level. The problem is different students hit that level at different times. But
sure.
It's a tough thing to do. In other words, I mean, part of the job of a professor is presumably to engage in some tough love,
right.
Which is, you know, to tell the student, look, I understand that you put effort into this. The problem is it's not good for reasons A through C. And the question is a professor going to be rewarded for doing that, or, you know, do you get good teaching evaluations by mostly being Mr. Happy Fun Professor?
Uh-huh. Right.
And the answer is that it's not clear. I mean, I think, you know, to be fair, you know, a lot of students don't like Happy Fun Professor. They want to know, you know, they want to be challenged. They want to be pushed. But it's not clear all students think that. You know, it depends how careerist the student is, among other things.
Right. Well, I mean, it depends which students you have.
Yeah.
All right. I think
we've talked that one to death.
All right.
All right, well, good talking to you.
Yes, you too.
All right, take care.
You too. Bye.